executive of the union
who
knows what he wants to accomplish, who has something in mind, is generally an individual who has a fair comprehension of what his objectives are and what the parameters are within which he is working. And if he has sense enough to come to his lawyer and describe what he wants accomplished and says, do you see any impediments? How can we do this? Is there anything wrong about this? He's going to get it done. And he's going to get the response from the lawyer that he's really seeking, which is counsel as to how to accomplish something. Now, obviously, the good lawyer will at some point say, as I have frequently had to say to union people, you can't do that. Well, why can't we do that? You can't do that because it's against the law. What do you mean it's against the law? Okay, you explain to them why it's against the law. Okay, I guess we give up. But that's the way in which it really should be done.
Yeah. I notice another role that many attorney general counsels play in keeping minutes of meetings. That's another way they control the action and writing up what the decision was and what's to be done. And
you are so
who keeps
right.
The master of it.
You are so right, Phil. I have kept the minutes for the Plumbers and Pipefitters Pension Fund from the time of its inception in 1956. And believe me, to illustrate your point, at one time at a Board of Trustees meeting, they got into a big argument about what had happened at a prior meeting, and Don McNamara, he's now the business manager of Pipefitters 636, Tom McNamara's son, Pat McNamara's nephew, one of the smartest guys you'll ever meet in the labor movement, Don says to everybody, hold it, he says, the minutes are what Siegel says they are. And he knew right then and there that that was the control. You know, it's what I put down and said took place that really counted. All of them, they could argue all they wanted to about what they thought took place. It's what I said it was. And you're right. Yeah. It's a big control.
Can I go back for a minute
Sure. Before
I forget it? Now, you've talked about the 1930s, when just as a relatively young kid, regardless of your education.
I was really a young kid.
And you went, who were some of the people? We've talked about people that had an impact like Ray Miller and Sidney Glaser and others, but what about in the labor movement? Who were the ones that, regardless of position, but just who had a role upon your thinking and commitment to your values?
Well, I would have to say that I don't think there were very many, because in a certain sense, I considered myself ahead of many of these. Let's speak very candidly. With Walter was a person whose values I knew, I understood, shared. I had a tremendous amount of respect for the redhead.
Yeah.
Victor was the kind of guy that I always thought was the epitome of the intellectual in the labor movement. A lot of respect for him. Roy Ruther. They were people who I would say were people who had an impact on me, demonstrating to me everything that I believed that could happen when working people addressed themselves to the problems of working people, formed organizations, exercised the power that comes with the organizations. And in the case of Walter, I simply thought of him as being a superb politician, because I can remember the days when the Socialist Party here in Detroit thought they could tell Walter what to do in the UAW. You see, when I said that there were radical lines into the labor movement, there were. There was the Communist Party hierarchy that was attempting to control, direct, influence particular people in the labor movement who held certain positions. And these were like political cells outside the labor movement trying to control people in the labor movement. Well, it was pretty clear, pretty obvious pretty soon, that the Socialist Party people were not going to tell Walter what to do, because he had a sense of how you succeed in this political arena of the union. And if he had followed them, he'd probably been a dead dodo. He had more sense of how to do things than they did. You know, what the hell did they know? They were just socialist theoreticians reading Marx, Engels, and everything since then, and deciding how things ought to be done, but not really successfully doing very much. Even Norman Thomas represents, shall we say, almost the itinerant minister conscience exemplified in the Socialist Party, not really ever believing that the Socialist Party would ever win an election in this country. Where is that city in Wisconsin where they've had a socialist mayor for I don't know how many years? The only place they've ever won anything like that. But so to come to and respond to your question, people like R.J. Thomas, people like Bill Marshall, who was a president of Chrysler Local 7, I thought of them as the salt of the earth, people out of the labor movement, honest to God workers, but not really very brainy in terms of experience, of knowledge. And I don't mean that I was in any way denigrating them, but when you say who would have an impact on me.
Maybe I should have rephrased it. Were there people, let me give you an example, and I'll tell you, I've always, one of the people that I met in the labor movement that had probably as one of the finest senses of history of any person is Nick DiGaetano, and had a tremendous impact upon starting this program here. And I came over the years to see Nick a lot and go out and visit with him and talk. And even though that I never had a role with him, I had tremendous respect for what he stood for. Not so much his impact on me, but for what he represented in the best of the labor spirit.
And I share that feeling, and it's more than that with me. It was personal, because mm-hmm. Nick and I were friends.
I know this.
And now Nick, you see, exemplified to me the true radical who saw this picture with real intelligence and understood his own role as a worker. In the bigger movement. Nick was involved in the politics of the local, but not, he, at the same time, he was also standing here on the sidelines as an observer and a recorder and a collector, in addition to being a participant. And there were not too many such people, to be perfectly honest. Nick was a remarkable gem in that respect. And, you know, if I have to try to think of others, I really don't know how many others I could name. Perhaps I could be. I went through this little booklet last night on purpose just to see the names, and I saw a lot of the names here that I do remember. Nick occupies a very special niche in my mind. There were guys like Al Barber. Now, Al Barber came out of Local 7. He moved on to the political scene. Al was witty, bright, cynical. I guess I think more in terms of product of the labor movement, that I like to think I had some connection with. Ed Carey, not only did he come from Local 7, he was from Pennsylvania by birth, like I was. So we had a tie, from more than one tie. Well, Ed, he was really an epitome of a good UAW member who grew into a politician, a one kind or another. Take Mel Ravitz. Now, you know, I took Mel Ravitz into the union movement. What you don't know, hasn't on here yet, is that in 1943 I became the executive secretary of the American Federation of Radio Artists. This was before television. Now, the American Federation of Radio Artists had a number of members here at WXYZ, where George Trendle owned the station, and they were putting on the Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet. WWJ, they had a contract where Harry Bannister was the manager and Ed Wheeler was his assistant. WXYZ, where Jimmy Riddell was the manager. WJR, where the manager was, I'll think of his name in a minute, because I couldn't organize that station for a long time. CKLW in Windsor, which I organized. Well, Mel Jerome Ravitz was working as Mel Jerome at WJLB, and I took him into the Federation of Radio Artists, which then became the Federation of Television and Radio Artists. We became friends. We went to a couple of conventions together, after conventions together, and we've maintained our friendship all these years. I think in terms of product. I think of Mel as being a product. Ed Carey, Al Barber, Tracy Dahl, a number of others that I can name who got into the public scene one way or another. I don't think so much in terms of what influence or impact they may have had on me as I do in terms of they are contemporaries of mine in a way. We work together, we accomplish something together. I guess that's the only kind
interaction
of
interaction would have been a better way rather than
that's
role.
Right.
But
that's
I'm
right.
Trying to get a spirit of a young socialist coming in with the values that you had and how you viewed other people. There's a couple other people that come to mind who were helped when we started the program that came out of the Socialist Party. Nicholas Hischka. Does that ring
no.
a bell?
I saw that name in there.
He was a friend of Nick's, John Onika and John Pansner.
Now Pansner, I've got to tell you, Anna Pansner, his wife, was the cook in Brighton in 1937.
Really?
Oh yes, she was the cook, and she had with her a Finnish woman whose name I don't remember. And so I used to see John and Anna when John would come out to the camp.
Oh, that's. I interviewed John once to show you the delicate nature of memory and history, and I wanted to get the days when he was in prison and. Being an IWW member, and he kept sending Anna out to get a six-pack of beer. So he says, Phil's thirsty. I wasn't thirsty at all. He wanted to get rid of her so he could tell me what it was like, because she didn't want the grandchildren to know that he had been in prison at San Quentin or Leavenworth. I forget which one he went to.
Yeah.
But as long as she was there, he talked about the 1930s. When she left, it was the 1920s. But Pansner was one of those with Nick that had an impact upon this program starting.
When you talk about someone who might have an impact on me, does the name Walter Nelson strike a bell with you? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, there is a man who had an impact on me.
Yeah.
Walter Nelson was an already older practicing attorney when I got out of school.
Yeah.
My first contact with Walter Nelson was at a law school convocation. One night we come to school, and they say, okay, everybody into, and this was down at High School Commerce, everybody into the library. We're gonna hear a debate between George Brand, who was the Butzel, Eamon, Long, Guston, Kennedy law firm, and Walter Nelson on the appointment or election of judges. And George Brand was the first speaker. And when he finished, I remember turning to someone sitting by me, I said, what the hell is the next guy going to say? Well, when Walter Nelson finished, the picture was just reversed. That was my first contact with him. And after I got into practice, I went to see him on a couple of... I had some guys who were members of Local 306, Bud Local 306, who were put in jail in Mount Clemens at the time of the Mount Clemens pottery strike. I was representing 306, Johnny Levy, at that time. So they called on me to try to get them out of jail. And lawyers today have no idea what the legal system was like when I started. I went out there to see a judge who was later on the Supreme Court, Judge Wiest. And he said to me, "You young man," he says, "you can do whatever you want to," he said. "Those men are going to stay in jail as long as I want to keep them there." Said that right out in open court. Now, of course, there's no reporter, no court reporter. This is, I'm just talking to him, he's on the bench. Or it may even have been in his chambers, I don't remember, but that's what he said. So I went to see Walter Nelson. I needed some help from someone who had been to the Michigan Supreme Court. In those days, you needed leave to appeal to get into the Michigan Supreme Court. Now, you need leave to appeal now because we have a court of appeals. But in those days, it was just the circuit court and the Supreme Court. But you couldn't get into the Supreme Court on a criminal case without leave to appeal. So I needed somebody who really knew his way around. I went to see Walter, and we went to work on this case. I later discovered that Wiest had called one of his friends up there in the Michigan Supreme Court and said, "Don't give this guy leave to appeal." We never got it. But I was so impressed with Walter. He spent time in prison. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, yes. Walter was an imprisoned minor. In fact, I'll take that back. Walter was imprisoned for contempt of the Michigan Supreme Court. He would not give them information on something growing out of, or would not give somebody information growing out of a strike. And he was imprisoned. Now, Walter is a man who really, I would say, Maurice Sugar, mm-hmm, made a real impression on me. Because I thought he was really a tremendous lawyer. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of people who I'd say had an impact on me.
I see.
Because I could genuinely look up to them and know that I was looking at someone whose values were like mine, you know, even though I was not ever a communist, and Maurice Sugar reputedly was part of the communist hierarchy, nonetheless, as I've told you, one of my closest friends, now dead, two of them were members of the Communist Party, and we fought like cats and dogs, but it had no impact on our personal friendship. And I could respect Maurice Sugar as far as you could respect anybody because of what I regarded his proper social attitudes and his accomplishments, his abilities.
He's a great man.
Oh, he was terrific.
Boaz, I think we should...
Okay.
I don't know the time, but I think...
What time is it?
It's 4:09.
Hey,
So...
We better quit.
Yeah, but let me just...